No wonder that in the climate of reaction to the eruptions of revolution and the Napoleonic Wars, the theory of uniformity became popular and soon dominant in the natural sciences. According to this theory, the development of the surface of the globe has been going on through all the ages without any disturbances. The process of very slow change that we observe at present has been the only process of importance from the beginning. This theory, first advanced by Hutton, 1795, and Lamarck, 1800, was elevated to its present position as a scientific law by Charles Lyell, a young attorney whose interest in geology was to make him the most influential person in that field, and by Lyell's disciple and friend, Charles Darwin. Darwin built his theory of evolution on Lyell's principle of uniformity. A modern exponent of the theory of evolution, H.F. Osborne, wrote, "Present continuity implies the improbability of past catastrophism and violence of change, either in the lifeless or in the living world. Moreover, we seek to interpret the changes and laws of past time through those which we observe at the present time." This was Darwin's secret, learned from Lyell. Lyell built his case with convincing dialectics. Wind and solar heat and rain little by little crumble the rock in the highlands. Rivers carry the detritus to the sea. The land is lowered by this process, which continues for ages, until it turns a vast region into detritus. Then the massive earth, as if in a slow breathing process, every phase of which requires eons, again slowly rises, the bottom of the sea subsides, and the crumbling of the rock begins all over again. The land comes up in an elevated plateau, the subsequent action of water and wind cuts furrows, and little by little the highland changes into a range of mountain peaks, morions, and these heights crumble too, wind and rain carrying them grain by grain into the sea. The shallow sea encroaches on the land, then slowly retreats. No great catastrophes intervene to change the face of the earth. Although sporadic volcanic action occurs, Lyell did not consider it to have an effect in changing the face of the earth comparable in importance to that of rivers, wind, and waves of the sea. What causes the eon-long process of elevation and subsidence has not been determined. Naturalists of the 18th century claimed to have observed a minute gradual change in the level of the Gulf of Bothnia in the Baltic Sea in relation to the coastline. Similar processes in past geological ages must have brought about all the changes on the earth: the majestic mountains that rose and others that were leveled, the seacoast that moved in a slow rhythm back and forth, and the earth mantle that was redistributed by rain and wind. According to the theory of uniformity, no process took place in the past that is not taking place at present, and not only the nature but also the intensity of physical phenomena of our age are the criteria of what could have happened in the past. Since the theory of uniformity is still taught in all places of learning, and to question it is heresy, it is pertinent to reproduce here some of Lyell's original statements, made in his Principles of Geology. They served as a manifesto or credo for all his followers, whether called uniformists or evolutionists. Lyell wrote, "It has been truly observed that when we arrange the known fossiliferous formations in chronological order, they constitute a broken and defective series. We pass, without any intermediate gradations, from systems of strata which are horizontal, to other systems which are highly inclined, from rocks of peculiar mineral composition to others which have a character wholly distinct, from one assemblage of organic remains to another, in which frequently nearly all the species, and a large part of the genera, are different. These violations of continuity are so common as to constitute in most regions the rule rather than the exception, and they have been considered by many geologists as conclusive in favor of sudden revolutions in the inanimate and animate world." Thus he acknowledged that the surface of the globe has the appearance of having been subjected to great and violent sudden changes, but he believed that the record is incomplete and that the major part of the evidence is lost. In the solid framework of the globe we have a chronological chain of natural records, many links of which are wanting. The theory of uniformity, or of gradual changes in the past measured by the extent of changes observed in the present, has, as Lyell admitted, no positive evidence in the incomplete record of the Earth's crust. Consequently, the theory, Building on argumentum ex silentio, or argument by default, required further analogies. Suppose we have discovered two buried cities at the foot of Vesuvius, immediately superimposed upon each other with a great mass of tuff and lava intervening. An antiquary archaeologist might possibly be entitled to infer, from the inscriptions on public edifices, that the inhabitants of the inferior and older city were Greeks, and those of the modern town Italians. But he would reason very hastily if he also concluded from these data that there had been a sudden change from the Greek to the Italian language in Campania. But if he afterwards found three buried cities, one above the other, the intermediate one being Roman, he would then perceive the fallacy of his former opinion, and would begin to suspect that the catastrophes by which the cities were inhumed might have no relation whatever to the fluctuations in the language of the inhabitants, and that, as the Roman tongue had evidently intervened between the Greek and Italian, so many other dialects may have been spoken in succession, and the passage from the Greek to the Italian may have been very gradual. This often reprinted passage is an unfortunate example, for, in order to prove that there had been no violent changes, Lyell chose to present a picture of violent catastrophes. The strata are separated by layers of lava. This is also the picture presented in so many geological surveys. To use this example as a proof of uniformity is a flight of dialectics. The comparison is followed by an accusation that is all the more vigorous because of the inadequacy of the example which is called on to substitute for geological evidence. Lyell said, "It appeared clear that the earlier geologists had not only a scanty acquaintance with existing changes, caused by wind, flowing water, etc., but were singularly unconscious of the amount of their ignorance. With the presumption naturally inspired by this unconsciousness, they had no hesitation in deciding at once that time could never enable the existing powers of nature to work out changes of great magnitude, still less such important revolutions as those which are brought to light by geology." And he proceeded, "Never was there a dogma more calculated to foster indolence, and to blunt the edge of curiosity, than this assumption of the discordance between the ancient and existing causes of change. It produced a state of mind unfavorable in the highest degree to the candid reception of the evidence of those minute but incessant alterations which every part of the earth's surface is undergoing." At first the tone of this pleading for the then unorthodox theory of uniformity was defensive. The position was unsupported by sufficient evidence. Then, as though a few analogies to human situations were so strong that they could substitute for the defective record of nature, the tone changed and became uncompromising. For this reason all theories are rejected which involve the assumption of sudden and violent catastrophes and revolutions of the whole earth and its inhabitants, theories which are restrained by no reference to existing analogies, and in which a desire is manifested to cut, rather than patiently to untie, the Gordian knot. Notwithstanding the strong language employed, the scientific principle which insists that whatever does not occur at the present time has not occurred in the past is a self-imposed limitation. Rather than a principle in science, it is a statute of faith. And Lyell ended his famous chapter accordingly, with an appeal for faith and with a precept for believers. If he, the student, finally believes in the resemblance or identity of the ancient and present systems of terrestrial changes, he will regard every fact collected respecting the causes in diurnal action as affording him a key to the interpretation of some mystery in the past. The hippopotamus inhabits the larger rivers and marshes of Africa. It is not found in Europe or America save in zoological gardens, where specimens of it wallow most of the time in pools, submerging their huge bodies in muddy water. Next to the elephant, it is the largest of the land animals. Bones of hippopotami are found in the soil of Europe as far north as Yorkshire in England. Lyell gave the following explanation for the presence of the hippopotamus in Europe. "The geologist may freely speculate on the time when herds of hippopotami issued from North African rivers, such as the Nile, and swam northward in summer along the coasts of the Mediterranean, or even occasionally visited islands near the shore. Here and there they may have landed to graze or browse, tarrying a while, and afterwards continuing their course northward. Others may have swum in a few summer days from rivers in the south of Spain or France to the Somme, Thames, or Severn River in Wales and England, making timely retreat to the south before the snow and ice set in. An Argonaut expedition of Hippopot army from the rivers of Africa to the Isles of Albion sounds like an idyll. In the Victorian cave near Settle, in West Yorkshire, 1,450 feet above sea level, under 12 feet of clay deposit containing some well-scratched boulders, were found numerous remains of the mammoth, rhinoceros, hippopotamus, bison, hyena, and other animals. In northern Wales in the Vale of Clwyd, in numerous caves remains of the hippopotamus lay together with those of the mammoth, the rhinoceros, and the cave lion. In the cave of Caigwin in the Vale of Clwyd, during the excavations it became clear that the bones had been greatly disturbed by water action. The floor of the cavern was covered afterwards by clays and sand containing foreign pebbles. This seemed to prove that the caverns, now 400 feet above sea level, must have been submerged subsequently to their occupation by the animals and by man. The contents of the cavern must have been dispersed by marine action during the great submergence in mid-glacial times, and afterwards covered by marine sands. Hippopot army not only travelled during the summer nights to England and Wales, but also climbed hills to die peacefully among other animals in the caves, and the ice, approaching softly, tenderly spread little pebbles over the travellers resting in peace, and the land with its hills and caverns in a slow lullaby movement sank below the level of the sea, and gentle streams caressed the dead bodies and covered them with rosy sand. Three assumptions were made by the exponents of uniformity. Sometime not long ago the climate of the British Isles was so warm that hippopot army used to visit there in summer, the British Isles subsided so much that caves in the hills became submerged, the land rose again to its present height, and all this without any action of a violent nature. Or was it, perchance, a mountain highway that crossed the land and poured into the caves and filled them with marine sand and gravel? Or did the ground submerge and then emerge again in some paroxysm of nature in which the climate also changed? Did the animals run away at the sign of the approaching catastrophe, and did the trespassing sea follow and suffocate them in the caves that were their last refuge and became the place of their burial? Or did the sea sweep them from Africa, throw them in heaps on the British Isles and in other places, and cover them with earth and marine debris? The entrances to some caves were too narrow and the caves themselves too shrunk, contracted, to have been places of refuge for such huge animals as hippopot army and rhinoceroses. Whichever of these answers or surmises is correct, and whether the hippopot army lived in England or were thrown there by the ocean, whether they sought refuge in caves or the caves are but their graves, their bones on the British Isles, as also on the bottom of the seas surrounding these islands, are signs of some great natural change. Icebergs. The theory that rejected the occurrence of catastrophic events in the past was incompatible with the then prevailing teaching, which ascribed the distribution of drift, the deposit of rock debris, clay, and organic material that covers continental areas, and of erratic boulders to the action of water in the form of great tidal waves breaking upon the continents. A slow, moving source, able to do the same work, but in a longer time, had to be found. Lyell assumed that icebergs transferred rocks over the expanse of the sea. Icebergs are broken off parts of glaciers that descend from the mountainous coasts to the sea. Mariners in northern waters have observed icebergs with pieces of rock attached to them. And if we think of the enormity of past geological epochs and multiply the action of icebergs as carriers of earth and rocks by the time elapsed, we may explain, so argued Lyell, the presence of erratic boulders as well as of till and gravel on land. Erratic boulders are found far from the seashore. Lyell taught that the land was submerged and icebergs traveling over it dropped their load of stones. Later the land emerged with the stones on it. Erratic boulders are found on the mountains. Therefore, these mountains were under shallow water when icebergs carrying stones from other regions dropped them on the summits. In order to explain in this manner the provenience of erratic boulders, it was necessary to submerge large parts of continents in rather recent times. In some places erratic boulders are distributed in a long string, as in the Berkshires. Icebergs could not have acted as intelligent carriers, and Lyell must have felt the weakness of his theory on this point. The only alternative known at that time was that of a tidal wave. But Lyell abhorred catastrophes. He detested them alike in the political life of Europe and in nature. Characteristically, his autobiography begins with this description of the most vivid memory of his early childhood: "I was 4½ when an event happened which was not likely to be forgotten. His family travelled in 2 carriages a stage and a half from Edinburgh. On a narrow road, with a steep brae above, and an equally precipitous one below, and no parapet on the roadside, a flock of sheep jumped down into the road, and frightened the horses of the other carriage. Away they ran, and with the chaise, man, horses and all, disappeared clean out of sight, over the brae in an instant. There was a rescue through the broken pane of glass, a little blood ran, and somebody fainted. One it left the first and strongest impression of his childhood in the memory of the author of The Theory of Uniformity. Darwin in South America. Charles Darwin, who had previously dropped his medical studies at Edinburgh University, upon his graduation in theology from Christ College, Cambridge, went in December 1831 as a naturalist on the ship Beagle, which sailed around the world on a 5-year surveying expedition. Darwin had with him the newly published volume of Lyell's Principles of Geology that became his Bible. On this voyage he wrote his journal, the second edition of which he dedicated to Lyell. This round, the world voyage, was Darwin's only field work experience in geology and paleontology, and he drew on it all his life long. He wrote later that these observations served as the origin of all my views. His observations were made in the Southern Hemisphere and more particularly in South America, a continent that had attracted the attention of naturalists since the exploration travels of Alexander von Humboldt, 1799-1804. Darwin was impressed by the numerous assemblages of fossils of extinct animals, mostly of much greater size than species now living. These fossils spoke of a flourishing fauna that suddenly came to its end in a recent geological age. He wrote under January 9, 1834, in the journal of his voyage, "It is impossible to reflect on the changed state of the American continent without the deepest astonishment. Formerly it must have swarmed with great monsters, now we find mere pygmies, compared with the antecedent, allied races." He proceeded thus: "The greater number, if not all, of these extinct quadrupeds lived at a late period, and were the contemporaries of most of the existing sea shells. Since they lived, no very great change in the form of the land can have taken place. What, then, has exterminated so many species and whole genera? The mind at first is irresistibly hurried into the belief of some great catastrophe, but thus to destroy animals, both large and small, in southern Patagonia, in Brazil, on the Cordillera of Peru, in North America and up to Bering's Straits, we must shake the entire framework of the globe. No lesser physical event could have brought about this wholesale destruction, not only in the Americas but in the entire world. And such an event being beyond consideration, Darwin did not know the answer. It could hardly have been a change of temperature, which at about the same time destroyed the inhabitants of tropical, temperate, and arctic latitudes on both sides of the globe. Certainly it could not have been man in the role of the destroyer, and were he to attack all large animals, would he also be the cause of extinction of the many fossil mice and other small quadrupeds?" Darwin asked. "No one will imagine that a drought could destroy every individual of every species from southern Patagonia to Bering's Straits. What shall we say of the extinction of the horse? Did those plains fail of pasture, which have since been overrun by thousands and hundreds of thousands of the descendants of the stock introduced by the Spaniards?" Darwin concluded, "Certainly, no fact in a long history of the world is so startling as the wide and repeated exterminations of its inhabitants." Out of Darwin's embarrassment grew the idea of extinction of species as a prelude to natural selection. Chapter 4, Ice: The Birth of the Ice Age Theory. In 1836, Louis Agassiz, a young Swiss naturalist, went with Professor Jean Charpentier, another naturalist, to an alpine glacier to demonstrate to him the fallacy of the new idea that an ice sheet once covered a large part of Europe. 4 years before, a teacher in a small town forestry school, A. Bernardy, had written, "Once the polar ice reached as far as the southern limit of the district which is still marked by the erratics." A botanist, C. Simper, had come upon the same idea, probably independently, and coined the term dies zite. He had succeeded in winning Charpentier to the hypothesis. At the edge of the glacier, Agassiz, who came as a skeptic, was himself converted. He became the chief apostle of the new theory. He built a hut on the glacier and lived in it, so that he could observe the movements of the ice, and thereby attracted the attention of naturalists and curiosity seekers all over Europe. The study of the glaciers in the Alps revealed that glacial ice may move by its own weight a few feet daily. It actually transports stones by carrying and pushing them. Some loose rocks are shoved aside to form lateral moraines, some are pushed by the advancing front of the ice to form terminal moraines. When the glacier melts and retreats, the loose rocks remain where they were at the time of the greatest expansion of the glacier. Agassiz assumed that the erratic boulders on the Jura Mountains had been carried there by ice from the Alps and that the trains of boulders in northern Europe and America had been formed by the gigantic glaciers that, sometime in the past, covered large parts of these continents. He also concluded that the drift had been brought and left by the ice sheet. Ice scratched the underlying rock with the help of flint and other fragments of hard stone it retained in its grasp, and it polished the rocky floors of slopes and valleys, and excavated the beds of lakes. Agassiz made his conclusions with respect to other parts of the world on the basis of observations limited to Switzerland and its surroundings. He thought that if he could convert two of the leading geologists, Buckland, the author of Reliquiae Diluvia, and Murchison, to the Ice Age theory and thus win their support, the task of gaining recognition for it would become much easier. Agassiz went to the British Isles. In later years, as his widow described it, recalling the scientific isolation in which he then stood, opposed as he was to all the prominent geologists of the day, he said, "Among the older naturalists, only one stood by me, Dr. Buckland, Dean of Westminster. We went first to the Highlands of Scotland, and it is one of the delightful recollections of my life that as we approached the castle of the Duke of Argyll, standing in a valley not unlike some of the Swiss valleys, I said to Buckland, 'Here we shall find our first traces of glaciers,' and, as the stage entered the valley, we actually drove over an ancient terminal moraine, which spanned the opening of the valley." A few weeks later, on November 4, 1840, Agassiz read a paper before the Geological Society of London, summarizing the excursion in the light of the Ice Age theory, and Buckland, who was then president of the society, followed with a paper of his own on the same subject. Even before the meeting, he had written to Agassiz of the success of his missionary work, "Lyell has adopted your theory in total. On my showing him a beautiful cluster of moraines, within 2 miles of his father's house, he instantly accepted it, as solving a host of difficulties that have all his life embarrassed him." Lyell, too, agreed to read a paper less than 3 weeks after this episode, on the day following the Agassiz and Buckland lectures. In this paper, hastily prepared, he explained the moraines in Great Britain in the light of Agassiz's teachings. At the November 4 meeting of the Society, Murchison attempted an opposition but, in the words of Agassiz, did not produce much effect. He added, "Dr. Buckland was truly eloquent." That same year, 1840, Agassiz published his theory in a work entitled Etudes sur les Glaciers. He wrote, "The surface of Europe previously adorned with tropical vegetation and populated by herds of huge elephants, enormous hippopotami, and gigantic carnivores, was suddenly buried under a vast mantle of ice, covering plains, lakes, seas, and plateaus. Upon the life and movement of a vigorous creation fell the silence of death. Springs vanished, rivers ceased flowing. The rays of the sun, rising upon this frozen shore, if, indeed, they reached it, encountered only the breath of winter from the north and the thunder of crevasses as they opened up across the surface of this icy sea. Agassiz regarded the inception and the termination of the Ice Age as catastrophic events. He believed that mammoths in Siberia were suddenly caught in the ice that spread swiftly over the larger part of the globe. He expressed the belief that repeated global catastrophes were accompanied by a fall in the temperature of the globe and its atmosphere, and that glacial ages, of which the Earth experienced more than one, were terminated each time by renewed igneous activity in the interior of the Earth, eruptions de Vinteria. Thus he maintained that the Western Alps had risen very recently, at the end of the last ice age, and were younger than the carcasses of mammoths in Siberia, the flesh of which is still edible. These animals, he thought, had been killed at the beginning of the ice age. With the renewal of igneous activity, the ice cover melted, great floods ensued, the mountains and lakes in Switzerland and in many other places were formed, and the relief map of the world was generally changed. It is often said that Agassiz added from 500,000 to 1,000,000 years to the recent history of the world by inserting the Great Ice Age between the Tertiary, or the Age of Mammals, and the recent, comprising the Late Stone Age and historical times. It should be borne in mind, however, that the 1,000,000-year span for the Ice Age is Lyell's estimate, and he interpreted Agassiz's theory in the spirit of uniformity. The theory of a continental ice cover was acceptable to Lyell. He agreed to it, satisfied to go no farther for his proof than 2 miles from his home. He realized that floating icebergs could not explain the phenomena of drift and erratic boulders in all places. The only alternative had been the waves of translation or tidal waves traveling on land, but this were outright catastrophic. Now, with the continental ice theory, he felt he had the correct solution if the catastrophic aspect of the theory, as originally suggested by Agassiz, a follower of Cuvier, was eliminated. It was not yet asked what produced such a cover. On the Russian plains, soon after the historic meeting at which the Ice Age theory was accepted by the majority of the members of the Geological Society, R.I. Murchison went to Russia, where he had been invited by Tsar Nicholas I to make a geological survey of the empire. Out of this survey grew recognition of the Permian system, the Permian, Silurian, and the Devonian. Also first recognized by Murchison, constitute 3 of the great divisions in the modern concept of early geological ages. For many months Murchison crossed the latitudes and longitudes of Russia, carefully observing the erratic boulders strewn over the Great Russian plains and rechecking the validity of Agassiz's theory. In Finland and the northern Russian provinces he found very large blocks, but they diminished in size the further south one went, which pointed to the action of water, a tide that came down from the north or northwest, spreading rock fragments along its way. He also observed that erratic boulders in the Carpathian Mountains were not of local but of Scandinavian origin. Of the drift, or the piles of stone, sand, clay and gravel which are spread out in such enormous masses over the low countries of Russia, Poland, and Germany, Murchison expressed the conviction that a vast portion, by far the greater part, has been transported by aqueous action, consequent of powerful waves of translation and currents occasioned by relative and often paroxysmal changes of the level of sea and land. Whatever may have been the cause of the eruption of the sea, such aqueous debacles, with the help of ice flows, produced the drift. Seeing that there are no mountains whatever from which a glacier can ever have been propelled in southern Sweden, Finland, or northeastern Russia, and yet that these regions are powerfully abraded, scored and polished, Murchison came to the conclusion that effects so extensively developed over such flat countries must have resulted from an erupting sea that also left behind enormous masses of debris and rolled stone. Murchison rejected the application of the terrestrial glacier theory of Sweden, Finland, northeastern Russia, and the whole of northern Germany, in short to all the low countries of Europe. He agreed that in mountainous northern Scandinavia and Lapland Arctic glaciers formerly did exist. Ice flows descending from these glaciers carried angular broken stones over land covered by sea and dropped them on top of the drift created by the eruption of the sea. Murchison called attention to the fact that Siberia is entirely free from erratic blocks, though environed on three sides by high mountains.